Is there one area of this industry where we're falling down, literally at times?
Literally, it is the lack of definition of what the ground model is. It's that going into all of this of, oh, I want four boreholes on this site, regardless of what the site may be. It's the people making assumptions and even designing to the boreholes. The boreholes are just a snapshot. They don't fit within the ground model you've got, then there's something wrong with the borehole. But again, you can't tell that unless you know what you're expecting to do and expecting to find.
That was Ian Webber from Coffee Geotechnics. Stick around to hear more from him and me, Steve Hadley, on this, the Breaking Ground podcast.
Central Piling are proud to sponsor the Breaking Ground podcast. It aligns with our goals of providing technical expertise, continuous improvement and community engagement. These are things we've been striving for since our inception over 40 years ago. Some of the engineering achievements during that time include the design and construction of the foundations for West London's tallest residential building, complex 3D finite element analysis to facilitate the creation of a triple story basement, and damage impact assessments for underground assets on a rotary cased piling contract. Our plant includes a wide range of bored piling machine sizes. These are continually being updated to ensure emission regulation compliance and efficiency. We're also able to offer driven precast and steel piling on selected contracts. To learn more about what we do and discover details of how we might be able to help you on your next foundation or retaining wall scheme, visit centralpiling.com.
Ian, welcome to the Breaking Ground podcast.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us. Your colleague and fan of the podcast, Raoul, has recommended I speak to you. He said, God, this amazing leader in our business. You've got to speak to him. He's been all around the world. I've got lots of views. Let's set this up. So I'm absolutely delighted that I could have you here with us. I think in that vein, really, what I'd like to do is start the podcast by discussing a little bit about your career journey, because I think it's so important to inspire young engineers by seeing that pathway that can be created and some of the things that you've achieved. So maybe if you could rewind us back to, is it the late 70s, early 80s?
Early 80s. I only look that old. I've had a very, very lucky career, really. I did my degree at Cardiff, and then I went on to do my master's at Newcastle, having spent a little bit of time as a site engineer for normal civil engineering works in between. And I did my master's in soil mechanics and foundation engineering. I went straight into consultancy. I worked for what was then Travers Morgan, which is now Capita. And my first change of job was relatively lucky as well, is that I went to what was then Kirkpatrick Geotechnics. They're now part of SWECO, known as SWECO, and I was the first recruit into their geotechnical team.
Okay.
So at the age of 24 or 25, I was suddenly very much on my own, trying to learn how to do geotechnics. And that was probably far too early for me.
Really thrown in the deep end there. I mean, you say, I would say lucky. There's that phrase, of course, the harder I work, the luckier I get. And but God, don't let me stop the flow of your story. Crack on.
My other version of that is hard work beats talent, particularly when talent doesn't work hard. Which is a more sported analogy one. Yeah. So I spent a couple of years there, but actually realised I was sinking as often as I was swimming, probably, in that I didn't really have the technical backup to do some of the things I was trying to do at that stage. And therefore, I went and joined Arups up in Scotland, and I spent 5 years with Arups, both in Scotland, and that was also my first introduction to international work. And I went over to Turkey for 18 months to design a major highway out of Istanbul.
Yeah.
And that was quite interesting, because that teaches you there is a different way than the UK way. And I think that's something that's quite important for engineers. It's not all about the way we do it in the UK. It's not necessarily the most efficient way of dealing with things.
Yeah, interesting that you'd identified that actually you weren't getting the support for your career development, although you had this fantastic opportunity to perhaps take on a lot of responsibility within Kirkpatrick, you didn't have enough support, and therefore you needed to put yourself into an environment in which you could develop. And I think that it's those choices that a lot of engineers have to make that can be really difficult, because, for instance, socially you might get on with a group of people, but you need to be making decisions for the future and the present.
I was 26 and leading geotechnics, and I didn't have the technical backup or capability to do that, and I felt exposed. And that was just how it had developed. I was the first in. I had about seven people working for me by that stage, and I felt massively exposed on some of the things we were doing. So I recognised a need to go and learn my technical trade better than I had it at that stage. And Arups, being fair to Arups, is probably one of the best learning grounds for learning your technical trade.
Yeah, it's well recognised, and I suppose not a coincidence that we've had a number of Arups engineers on this podcast, because it is an excellent company, and they do develop. They look into, sorry, this isn't a sales pitch for Arup, but I think it's widely acknowledged that they look into new techniques, and they are at the forefront of technology.
I think the advantage I had is I went into that having probably learnt my commercial side of it before I learnt my technical side of it. And that's sometimes the criticism of Arups, is that they're very good technically, but the commerciality of some of their engineers takes a long time to come through.
Yeah.
Whereas I'd come from a very harsh commercial background, which was very much about marketing and about, financial performance, but I didn't have the technical at that point. So Arups taught me the technical to go with the commercial side I had. I then got approached to basically set up WA Fairhurst and Partners, which Fairhurst as they are now, then their geotechnical team. So again, I was a first in to set up their geotechnical team, which we grew to being the largest largest geotechnical team in Scotland, and then started to venture further south and do more work in the UK. And again, a little bit was right place at right time, because at that time, the end of my time with Arups and the beginning of my time with Fairhurst was when design and build first kicked off. And design and build was very much being trialled in Scotland. And so we learnt about it all in Scotland, and then took those skills originally to England and then subsequently over to Ireland, as both England and Ireland went into a D&B as a main route for procuring civils work.
Right.
And that's really where my background came to, is very much in that D&B space of working for contractors.
Did that change the approach much in terms of the consultancies? But traditionally, maybe I'm doing an injustice to some of the consultancies out there now, but traditionally, I think consultancies have been viewed as being very conservative in their approach, because really there's not a lot for them to gain from being more optimistic in their approach to designs.
This is probably the way that I describe it best, is that construction is about risk assessment. And at the end of the day, that's what we're doing. We're assessing risk. We can be very conservative and have very little risk, or we can be riskier but have contingency for when things go wrong. Go as simple as something like observational techniques are very much along that line. So what we do and what we try and do for our contractors is we describe the risk to them. We explain what the risks are and the consequences and the mitigations of if that risk becomes a reality. And at that point, it's for the contractor to decide if that risk is acceptable. I used to do some lectures many years ago about when D&B was first going. And the problem is, the more people you get involved, everybody adds their own factor of safety. So the more people involved, you end up with a factor of safety of 7 rather than the 1.5 you really aimed for, because everybody adds a little bit.
And I suppose with the ground, there's more unknowns or more uncertainty, and therefore you can end up with a very conservative design if you're not careful.
And as long as the big consultants keep producing those conservative designs, the greater the work we have, because our job is to actually explain the risk or the opportunity that is in there in order to give the contractor the commercial edge.
And would you be taking on those contracts and your involvement at early stage as a risk yourself? You know, is your time with, let's say you're working alongside, I don't know, Lango Rourke, just plucking a main contractor's name out there, and you're developing an embankment scheme for them for a new infrastructure project. The time you spend on that is, are you doing that free of charge on the basis that you might win the next main work?
my easy answer to that is, why would I? You know, no, we don't. We don't work for nothing. We will work at a reduced fee and a win bonus, because we will buy into the win. And we're quite open to good commercial arrangements. We've done a couple of jobs where the contractor has won it, where we've said we'll work for a percentage of the savings we identify for them. Okay. It gives us a better criteria to chase after to deal with that.
Of course.
So we won't work for nothing. And I think the other side of it, and this is probably a bit further on into the conversation, is we have a reputation now where for a lot of the big infrastructure jobs, we get approached by more than one of the contractors. And therefore, why would we work for nothing? There's a competition for us because we add value. We identify those risks to give the contractor a better opportunity to win the tender. So we're valuable to him, probably more so at tender, possibly, than at detailed design stage.
Would that not be a conflict of interest to be providing design information to more than one?
We only ever work for one at a time.
Right.
Okay. It can often be that we'll work for one in tender. If we don't win it, the winners will then ask us to take over for them. And that's happened on numerous occasions.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to get that insight, because I've spent the last 20 odd years of my career in the piling market, and all of the sort of tendering design that we do, that is all at risk. You know, we don't get paid for any of that work. So interesting to see that there is another way. I wish that we could get a fee for it, but I rather suspect that that's not going to change anytime soon. But, you know, it is different, because that is your selling point, you know, the design, whereas us really is on the construction side. Interesting talking about commercial stuff, and clearly from quite an early stage in your career, you've had an interest in commercial activity. Was that really the driver for you setting up Weber Associates? Was it a desire to have an entrepreneurial streak, let's call it, Rod?
Ooh. It was an accident. I was at the time geotechnical director for Fairhurst, but myself and three others had identified that there was this gap in the market for providing good quality, pragmatic design for contractors. You know, the buildability bit. And I was probably the most junior of the four of us. So we set about sort of deciding that we would set up our own consultancy to deliver it. Equally, being the most junior of the group, I think I was out making the tea when they decided somebody needed to give up and actually commit to it, and I lost that vote. So I gave up my role within Fairhurst in order to concentrate on getting this launched, which was a great idea, but I probably did that. So I set Weber Associates up with the view that it would last for 3 months. It was just a mechanism for somebody to pay me so that I could feed myself. Right. Unfortunately, over that 3 months, we came across a commercial issue that we couldn't agree between ourselves, and therefore it fell apart. And at which point, I'd given up my proper job and had set up a one-man band consultancy, which was actually quite good fun. So I kept going, and that was how it set up. So, to answer your question, yes, there was a commercial streak within me. There was an entrepreneurial streak because I, among with others, had identified a gap in the market. Sadly, how I went about it was not quite the conventional way that most people would go about it. And by accident, I then found myself with a business to run.
Yeah, well, you clearly took full advantage of that luck or opportunity, whatever you might want to call it. And it grew, and you mentioned you were bought out by Coffee, who presumably a global geotechnical business.
Coffee are a huge geotechnical business. They've subsequently sold out themselves to Tetra Tech. But Coffee was primarily a geotechnical business in Australia. And they had, at that stage, over 500 geotechnical staff in Australia. And they decided they wanted to go international. Right. So they bought some companies in the UK and also in Canada. And after that, also in South America. And what attracted me to them was they were very much based around being a geotechnical specialist. They had other specialisms, but their core was as a geotechnical specialist. And that working for a specialist as opposed to a multidisciplinary was actually quite an appeal. And if you go back 14 years, there was there's been a lot lately of consultant consolidation, but a lot of the big consultants were expanding by acquisition rather than by internal growth. And there was a reasonable regularity of people knocking on the door to say, can we buy you? And nice. Coffee was also also quite nice in that they paid me more and put less restrictions on it. And
perfect.
So, yeah, that's 14 years ago now.
And it's presumably provided you with a platform to take on maybe a greater variety of projects and bring in new skills within the UK business.
To a certain extent, I think they also gave me the opportunity to see whether we could do it internationally. It's relatively easy. It's doable when you're working in the market you already know to sell that high-end geotechnical market that you become known for. But to actually go to enter into a new market was a challenge that I hadn't tried before. And
yeah,
well, I was just going to say, you
alluded to your time, I think you said it was in Turkey earlier in your career, relatively briefly with Arup. How would you contrast the approaches to geotechnics around the world? Because you cover Europe and the Middle East, don't you?
So I also have an office in Dubai, which I actually set the geotechnical team up in Dubai as well as the... and that was through Coffee, and Coffee allowed me that opportunity to do that. And so we've now had a geotechnical team in Dubai for 10 years. And we have a similar profile in Dubai that we have in the UK. We tend to go in helping contractors, doing the more interesting jobs in a way. So probably the biggest one we've done there in recent years is Brookfield Place, which was the biggest basement ever built in Dubai. It was over 30 metres deep in the middle of the financial district. And it won various awards with Foster's and Robert Bird's as the other people in there, which was quite interesting because it was building a basement within an old basement, but taking it deeper. Because it built a basement and then filled it with sand when the financial crisis hit, and we had to go back in and find our way around it.
But clearly the market came back strong enough that there was even more money to do a bigger basement after that. So presumably diaphragm walls construction?
No, it wasn't. And the reason for that was we had to effectively get all the piling around. There was a little bit of diaphragm wall, but most of it was contig piling because we had to miss the existing piles that were already there. So it wasn't a straight line. It was a bit wavy with the wall. Deliberately.
And there was no groundwater down to 30 metres, or did you?
Oh, there was groundwater, but we had to do... It was secant, not contiguous.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's very impressive to get the interlock down to that sort of depth. Yeah. So your role at Coffee, was that as the main designer? I know on these really complex schemes, you can have your main designer, and then you've got another checking designer, and then you've got building control... checking out everything.
It varies in different places. I mean, most of the time we act as the main geotechnical designer. There's often a lead designer that we provide the geotechnical specialism to. On that one, we did all the concept design, which then went out to tender to the piling contractor, who then had the the responsibility for detailed design, but we were also the cut-through checker.
Right.
So we put the original scheme together. They followed it, and then we checked it. But that, I mean, that's just a particular individual job.
How would you contrast the role of building control in the different countries? Because we see differences in the UK according to what type of structure is it. And as some people won't pay any attention to the design work involved on a scheme, and then the next building control engineer is looking in a lot of detail. But I wondered how involved they are in the approach.
Dubai is quite interesting in that the municipality, a lot of it's tied into, partly into licensing, but also tied into what you're allowed to do. So we've just finished, probably a year ago now, Dubai Harbour Creek, of which we've done the pile draft design for 25 towers in the new part of Dubai that is where Dubai's expanding to next, which is also where they're going to be building the new tallest building in the world once they decide how tall it needs to be. And so we've just finished that. But one of the things that they banned for a long while in Dubai out of the municipality was that you couldn't do power draft foundations because it had so many problems of people not knowing how to design them properly. But then they relented and let us do that, and actually also said that actually we should be the key checker wherever that may be required. Now, I'd like to take a lot of credit for that, but actually I must also own up that Harry Poulos, who has been involved in a lot of the big buildings in Dubai, is held in such regard over there, and he's obviously works for Coffey. He gave us the name to allow us to do it more than necessary what we did.
I didn't realise he worked for you. It's a name that I've seen on lots of geotechnique papers, but not actually come across him in the industry. So,
yeah, the purpose of this is not a sell of coffee, but Harry has been involved in 9 of the 10 tallest buildings in the world.
Oh, that's something to be celebrated, I think. It's interesting to see the different approaches. One thing that I know that you are passionate about is making sure that the information we get before we design structures is right. And you're involved in a lot of legal cases over the years in your capacity as an expert witness. I should add quickly before anybody thinks of any problems
so far,
with your designs.
Yeah.
Where legally do we stand in terms of whose responsibility is it to come up with the right sort of ground model, ground investigation report?
I'll go two ways. I'll answer it in two different ways. The first part I would say is that it depends upon the conditions of contract. And I think that's the real key to all of this. Under traditional conditions of contract, it's up to the client's engineer to make sure there is enough site investigation there. Under the other end of the contract scale of a turnkey type contract, give me a row between here and there, then actually everything is passed over to the contractor, and therefore he does whatever investigation he feels is necessary. I think there is a problem of lack of understanding of where the contract conditions take the risk, and there's certain parts of the UK where the risk is so heavily loaded on the contractor it makes it quite difficult for them to do anything, because the risk profile becomes very high. But equally, while there's a high risk profile, there isn't then the time for them to do the investigation to mitigate that risk. So you go into contract with poor information, but the contractor carrying all the risk. Now, I think that's a very unfair position. You've either got to give the contractor the time to do the investigation, or you've got to give him enough investigation in order to properly evaluate the risk that he's having to deal with.
Yeah, we have situations where we have very poor quality information come through. We say, look, really, we need more. I said, well, there's no more that's available. Therefore, we have to use local information, make certain assumptions, and do our best to check what there is, and err on the side of caution in terms of our design approach. But I do wonder whether legally we should be forcing the client to provide us with more detailed information to ensure that sort of the Eurocode compliance, the standard, you know, going 5 meters beyond the borehole, beyond the pile depth, and so on. You know, if that went to court, for instance, and we didn't have a really good quality site investigation, and there was a problem with the building, whose responsibility is it? Is it the client because they didn't provide good enough information, or is it the contractors because they didn't force the issue and get hold of it before they started work?
And the and what's happening in more and more of the infrastructure contracts is all that risk is put onto the contractor. And so it is deemed that the contractor has taken the ground risk out of it. He's bought the ground risk on, as you put it, very poor information. So the question really needs to be asked is, why do we keep getting really poor information? And that's because most of the clients are public sector clients for major infrastructure projects, and therefore they choose their consultants on the basis of price. And that's all they're interested in. So it's a race to the bottom of who can provide the outline design the cheapest. And at that point, there is no incentive for that designer to actually make sure everything is right, come up with the best design, come up with anything else. It's about getting something out there, knowing that all the risk is going to be passed to the contractor, who may have 12 weeks where somebody else has had 2 years to produce something that's not buildable. He's then got 12 weeks to turn that round into something that is efficient, cost-effective, and can be built, and understand the risk that the people who've got no money have put together just to get themselves through a process of how they've won the job.
Yeah. Ian, I read something really interesting that you wrote in a presentation. It was that boreholes should just confirm what you already know, which I think is something that we should all take into designing ground investigations.
It's a bastardisation of a quote from my structures lecturer, who says you should never do a calculation unless you know what the answer is, because you can't tell whether you've got it wrong or not if you don't know what the answer should be. And I see a lot of people going out and saying, right, we need boreholes every 25 metres. I did a job in Pakistan. The boreholes were 1.5 kilometres apart. But it was perfectly acceptable because they investigated the geology. They didn't investigate every 25 metres regardless of what the geology was doing. And if you look at the Channel Tunnel, I'm almost coming to some of my lecture points, but if you look at how many boreholes were done for the Channel Tunnel, it was in tens, not in hundreds.
That's interesting. Okay.
Because they investigated the geology. So once they understand once they put their ground model together, Channel Tunnel went through the Chalk Marl. And so as long as they knew where the Chalk Marl was, that's all they needed.
Yeah, it wouldn't change the construction type or size of the tunnel sections, particularly if it was slightly weaker chalk in one place than the next. Just the fact that it was chalk was the important thing.
Well, it was a chalk marl that they were that they were targeting, and there's a layer of chalk marl that runs through and under the channel. But there was very, very few boreholes. Bill Rankin's paper on it is actually worth a read. But that really brings home that what we shouldn't be doing is just doing a regular grid of site investigation. What we need to do is actually understand what the ground is, what the geology is, what the geomorphology is, and then design our investigation around it. I think in that same presentation that you read, I point out that there is no point doing rotary boreholes in very soft alluvium, and there's no point doing CPTs in granite. Somebody will pick that up and tell me I'm wrong, but you know, in principle, that's true. So in order to design your site investigation, you've got to know what you're going through.
Yes, and that information, it's fairly easy to access. We've got the BGS boreholes, and you know, if you've been working in the industry long enough, you've probably got a nice database in your own office anyway of borehole logs and so on. So, yeah, you should be able to access that. Of course, things do go wrong, and that's sort of fallen in your lap in the last few years, particularly as an expert witness. I wonder what sorts of failures you're seeing commonly around the world, and when things have gone wrong, generally speaking, whose fault is it? Because we've got all these different parts of geotechnics. Is there one area of this industry where we're falling down, literally at times?
Literally, it is the lack of definition of what the ground model is. It's that going into all of this of, oh, I want four boreholes on this site, regardless of what the site may be. It's the people making assumptions and even designing to the boreholes. The boreholes are just a snapshot. If they don't fit within the ground model you've got, then there's something wrong with the borehole. But again, you can't tell that unless you know what you're expecting to do and expecting to find. And I sort of keep a running tally of what's the key driver of these. And I see four key ones. First of all, is that lack of a proper desk study. Mm-hmm. It's fairly interesting when you ask consultants, and when I do these, do these lectures for industrial clients, of how many of them actually look at stereo air photographs now. It's a requirement of the British standard, but people don't, and people don't understand the geomorphology. Go back to my experience in Turkey. I worked with a very, very good geomorphologist, and we designed the first 10 kilometres of a major six-lane motorway, including viaducts, culverts and everything else, on the back of air photographs.
Right. Interesting, actually. One of the recent podcasts we had was we were discussing the Miami building collapse and talking about how they were able to use satellite images to look at the level changes over a period of time, and they could see that that structure had been sinking, but actually land's always been changing. That's just a new tool for us to have at our disposal. Do you see often, actually, it's a structural issue, so maybe a problem with the specification or the installation or the quality of the materials? So let's say, take for instance, a retaining wall. Actually, it's the structural part of the design that's causing the problem that then leads to a geotechnical failure. Or is because there's more risk in the ground, does it tend to be a lack of understanding of the ground model that's causing the problem?
I say primarily it's lack of understanding of the ground model. I think there's also a lack of understanding at times between the geotechnical and the structural designer. And the biggest thing that is happening in the legal cases I seem to get involved in lately, particularly in the UK, is all the logistics centres and all the distribution warehouses, where we've got very, very tight settlement criteria on the floor slabs. Interestingly enough, the design of the floor slab doesn't talk about settlement. There's no settlement criteria required. There's just a relative level requirement in order for your racking to work. And so I would say that probably 60% of what I see coming through the legal routes at the moment is about failures of floor slabs in distribution warehouses.
So really we're talking about serviceability failures rather than ultimate failures, which seems to be a theme over a few of the podcasts, actually, that we so often in geotechnics we design for the ultimate capacity, but actually that almost becomes irrelevant a lot of the time, because something like a slab for a warehouse, take for instance piles, and definition of pile failure might be defined as 10% of the diameter. It might be nowhere near that, but actually a 5 or 10 mil settlement might cause the racking to fail within that structure.
And that's correct. So we come across a lot of slope stability failures, and particularly slope stability failures during construction, where that hasn't been properly controlled. But actually, how many foundation failures have I seen in my career? I can tell you is one of actual ultimate failure of a foundation. You know, so it's very rare you actually get complete failure of a foundation, because we've got a factor of safety of 3 on it. So that means we've got to get it really, really wrong for it to fall over. Whereas in slopes, we work at a factor of safety of 1.3, so we only have to get it a little bit wrong for it to fall over.
Well, that will help me sleep tonight, Ian, so thank you for that.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, so it's no surprising that we don't get many ultimate failures. Funny enough, one of the big floor slab jobs that I was involved in did have an ultimate failure of the pile, but that then led on to the whole side of it.
When these things do go wrong, we're talking such big money, I think people need to look at the contractual side of things. The insurance is a really hot topic at the moment with the way the premiums have changed, certainly subsequent to Grenfell. But looking at limits on liability and trying to speak to clients around that, because clients at times, they actually may be a lot more exposed than they think they are. And it may be that it's better to spend more money on a more conservative design or better testing or instrumentation or ground investigation to mitigate those risks.
I also think, and one of the reasons I think that insurance premiums are going through the roof, is that actually the size of the claims are getting bigger. I've now done 3 expert jobs where the claims have been over 200 million. Now, nobody carries £200 million worth of PI.
No.
And I've done several that are in the tens of millions that very few people carry that level of PI. So the size of the claims are getting huge. You know, to go to court costs you the best part of £2 million in legal fees.
So what happens in that circumstance? Because a lot of time, and we do it ourselves, we will limit our liability on the project to the cover that we got in terms of, yeah, of insurance. And I'm sure that goes throughout the world.
we all try and do that. Yeah.
maybe we're more successful at slipping it into our terms than others.
I won't go out with an unlimited liability contract. But that's partly is okay for the designers, but the contractor has actually got a different issue at times. Because the contractor gets caught on consequential losses. He gets caught on a fitness for purpose role rather than a negligence role. And therefore, the costs of these claims start to go higher and higher and higher. And so what's quite interesting is the limit of liability clause has never been tested in Ireland. And so what's happening in Ireland at the moment, there are a couple of cases going through the courts there where they're testing whether you can actually put a limit of liability into the contract that runs all the way through. So, and I don't want to get into legal stuff because I'm not a lawyer, but you start to see these sort of things happening where the exposure that people are taking on is actually quite large. And, you know, the values of some of these are just scary. They will put companies out of business.
So I get clients asking me from time to time, can I get project-specific insurance for them? You know, they might want 20 or 50 million pound cover for a particular scheme. My broker tends to tell me that there's nothing available. And in fact, we increased our insurance, PI insurance, significantly a couple of years ago, but have got that across the board. What options are there out there for designers and for clients?
Well, I think we've got to educate the client in what is available and what they can do. Because the problem is when the clients come and ask for, whether it be 25, 50 million of PI, then very few people in the market have got that. So they then got to go to their brokers and negotiate an extra premium to provide that for the projects. Now, if you take any of the major projects, you'll often have several parties involved in them. So it may be, you know, a main contractor, a lead, you know, a prime subcontractor, and a couple of designers thrown in for good measure. So there's 4 people chasing extra premium or looking for extra insurance that attracts extra premium. What's been available for quite a long time, and it had a little bit of a spell about 10 years ago, was where the client takes out project-specific insurance that covers everybody.
Mm.
And that's really, really useful because it takes away a lot of the conflict that then comes out of it and allows people to be what they are.
Well, I was just going to ask, does it take out the conflict? Because surely that particular insurer would go, yeah, we've got project insurance, but it's the fault of this geotechnical contractor, therefore we're going to claim off that, the first 10 million, let's say, we're going to claim off them because that was the level of cover under the contract?
That's not necessarily the case. So if you think of contractors or risk insurance, that's the contractor's all risk. So if he gets it wrong, he's got an insurance cover that pays for it. The one of the ones that I know where they have project-specific insurance was a road scheme, and they actually all signed up to a no-sue agreement at the same time. So, you know, here's the insurance. If we get it wrong, that's where the insurance is based. And I'm not saying it was cheap, but, it was one person rather than, in that case, about 10 people chasing the extra premium on the insurance.
Well, maybe they got a cheaper price for the works because of it. Who knows?
And maybe so, but it also made it was very clear within the insurance business of who was holding it. Whereas, you know, we get a lot of examples where the insurance, it is not clear where the insurance sits between a contractor or risk, a API, or even a public liability situation, and particularly when things go wrong, as to which part of the insurance is in. And of all the legal jobs I've done, the most scary one was when it was a dispute between three insurance brokers as to, they knew they had to, one of them had to pay, and they were trying to blame, say, was covered by the other.
It was pass the parcel, was it?
Yeah.
Actually, a more progressive route would be to get the client to understand that is the most that we can support. If you're worried about it, let's look at other ways to mitigate the potential risk. And so, I know instrumentation, testing, that's something that we've seen become more prominent, certainly instrumentation in terms of retaining walls in recent years. Is that reflected around the world, or is that something that's more in the UK?
I think it's probably more in the UK than necessarily around the world. I think we are slightly more conservative. We are slightly more historically having an involvement of the designers through the process. And again, one of my hobby horses on this is that people specify the instrumentation without really understanding what it then means when they get the results. And I've seen a number of horrifying examples of where, you know, somebody has said, right, you know, put in this instrumentation and measure it every week. And people have done so. And when it falls over, you've got a beautiful record from all the instrumentation that was read of why it fell over. But nobody's actually looking at it, and the engineer doesn't have, or the designer doesn't have that input through construction to actually make sure that actually what he's designed and what he's expecting from his design is actually what's been shown in the instrumentation. And I've got three or four case studies that where something was instrumented to death or tested to death, and it was beautifully tested, it was beautifully recorded, and everything was filed beautifully, but nobody looked at what it meant.
No, and is it responding quickly enough to movements, for instance, as well, and put in appropriate action in place? And, you know, sometimes I see these ground movement assessments, saw one today actually, I won't say what site, but it did say slight to moderate damage. And that's going through a party wall process right now. I think, well, as a party wall, would you accept that? Is it reasonable to think, right, there's going to be a load of cracks in my building, there's going to be some structural work that is required and redecoration required after the neighbours have had their basement constructed? Why would they accept that? But I suppose it's just understanding exactly what will be involved. And, you know, there will be no basement construction without a degree of movement. It's just trying to understand what's acceptable. As a policy that we put into our terms and conditions to say that our clients should get it, which is the non-negligent cover. Because quite often we're constructing things that it will have an impact. It could damage structures nearby, but there's nothing really that we can do about it. It's just a consequence of how we operate. and therefore clients should be making an allowance for that. I don't know how complicated that can get legally. Have you seen?
Well, we did the damage assessment for Crossrail, for the tunnelling at Crossrail. You can't build a tunnel without it settling either, and you know, every geotechnical name has been accredited with the statement of if I spit on it, it'll settle. So we, you know, you do that, you therefore assess what the damage is going to be. And on things like Crossrail, on Jubilee Line, they had a process in place for dealing with the landowners above where they were tunnelling.
And a lot of the time that is going in and doing jet grouting, isn't it, to stay below the ground?
It's more compensation grouting to push the building back up, but equally you've got to make a decision at what level of movement and what level of damage do you then put compensation grouting in for.
Right.
And so, you know, you can do an assessment of that, but for things like Crossrail, for things like Jubilee Line, there was a process in place for doing it, and the client accepted there was some money required for doing it. The problem when you get to private development, they often don't recognise those issues to the same extent. So therefore it then becomes a legal battle of, well, you did this and therefore I've now got a crack in my wall. We want loads of money to rebuild our house because of it. Or whatever it may be. Yeah.
it's a complex world, and there's so many impacts from what we do, and there's a range of alternatives for how we do it. And thank you, Ian, for discussing some of those alternatives and sharing your journey with us today. It's been fascinating to hear. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm pleased to say that since our last episode with Dave Petley on slopes and climate change, we really seem to have grown our listener numbers. Thank you if you're one of those that are new to the podcast. Really appreciate you taking the time to listen to us, and hope to engage with many of you soon. Speaking of which, we are trying to form a LinkedIn group which will enable me to facilitate some Q&A sessions with our guests. So please keep an eye out for that.